so happy we have this thing called KYC. It works so well.
It's not a honeypot or anything, is it?
The right to transact comes before every other right. Is money part of speech? Maybe it does fall under the First Amendment.
The ability to transact, I think, should be enshrined in the Bill of Rights. If you can't go out and buy a gun, can you really have the right to bear arms?
Yeah.
In 2013, Coinbase opened their doors. They were really the first exchange that made it easy to buy.
Yeah.
Before that, everybody was getting their Bitcoin through mining. You're a producer instead of a consumer. Around 2013, the timeline split. The buyers actually have forgotten what it's like to mine. As a result, there's been downstream consequences. Publicly traded mining companies, those guys have a fiduciary responsibility to return dollars to their investors, not Bitcoin. All this hash rate that's been on the network, it's there using Bitcoin as a stepping stone to dollars. They're not necessarily going to care that the mining pools are starting to get centralized, that all the hardware comes from just one entity in China. The fact that the Bitcoin community went off to buy their Bitcoin instead of mine it has caused some problems.
Honestly, if you look at a lot of the pubcos turning off and going towards AI, so like that's happening at a major scale. I mean, it kind of allows people who are OGs and who really care about the mission of Bitcoin and that are in the mining community, yourself, myself, to have a little bit more of the pie.
Down a rabbit hole. Cypherpunk.
My guest grew up on a cranberry farm in Oregon, spending a decade putting solar on rooftops all across the United States. And now he lives where the Andes drop into the Amazon in Peru, running a Bitcoin mining company from the jungle. He's the co-founder and CEO of Saz Mining, built on one almost heretical idea. You're supposed to mine your Bitcoin the way Satoshi designed it, not buy it through the surveillance rails of an exchange. He calls fresh coins off the network wild sats. He calls most of the hash rate out there fiat hashers. And he thinks the Bitcoin community has a little amnesia to get over. Kent Halliburton, welcome to Cypherpunk.
Stoked to be here, man. Great intro. Yeah, it makes my life seem more exotic than I think it is.
Wow, he was on a cranberry farm. We did solar mining, Bitcoin. Come on, spice something up for us here.
I grew up on the southern Oregon coast.
Okay.
And my pops was actually a sawyer in a lumber mill. So that's a big area of timber in the world, right? And my pops kind of saw his like early 80s that the writing was on the wall, that he wanted to be in an ecosystem that was outside of timber, but still able to work outside and work with his hands. And so he started hunting around for opportunities and he noticed cranberries as a viable approach to making an income and paying for family and all that. And so he found a lady that was a bit older and was looking to sell the farm. She'd raised her family on it. And a World War II vet had started the cranberry farm and he bought it. And we moved there when I was 5 years old. I don't know much about those early days, but moved there and I grew up there. So basically most of my memories from childhood life are living on a farm.
Did you have to put in some proof of work on the farm?
I don't think it was a matter of choice. You got to.
What was your favorite part?
Favorite part for me or favorite part for my dad to give me?
Both.
Those are two different things. My favorite part was probably weed eating. So cranberries are unique in that you harvest them by flooding the fields. The cranberries float. So you go out there with the machine that knocks the fruit off the vines and they float up to the surface, right?
Uh-huh.
So as a result, you have to design the fields in this manner to begin with, which means there's dikes that go around the field, right?
Sort of short.
Yeah. Anyway, dikes that go around the field. And so one of my jobs was to weed eat. So I did enjoy that, just kind of get into a mindless state of just weed eating and cleaning the dikes of all the plants. And that was to keep the seeds from going into the cranberry fields. Mm-hmm. But the job my dad liked to give me was a shovel and digging a ditch. You know, I think it was his way. We were talking about football earlier on, but I think it was his way of, hey, let's get you strong for football.
So you told me you played football. What position did you play?
Never off the field. It was a small team. So I grew up in a town where my graduating class is like 53 kids.
Oh, wow.
And so 11-man football, but I played defensive end, offensive end, and special squad. I mean, my senior year, I don't think I ever came off the field.
Wow. Wow. Oh, that's awesome. So how'd you get into solar? I know like the jump from solar to Bitcoin mining is kind of like, it makes sense, right? Like if you're in solar and like you're in energy, like going to Bitcoin and understanding mining is like a natural progression. But what got you into solar? I read you worked for Elon's company or Elon's brother's company?
I competed against them.
Oh, you competed against them.
So,
okay.
So, yeah. Don't be shabbing me here now. No,
gotcha.
So I got to rewind a little bit. So cranberry farm, at one point during high school, I had a taste of surfing. And that led me, you know, my parents took a family vacation to Hawaii and got a taste for surfing. And I was like, I've got to do more of this. And so when I started to get close to graduating high school, I discovered Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And I kind of like computers. I kind of like science. And so they had a computer engineering program, applied to it and got in. A funny enough story, The computer that I got for my graduation present to be a computer engineer was actually one designed by Bob Burnett. And when he was
a gateway
CTO.
Computer?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
A gateway computer. So yeah, I got a computer engineering degree on a computer that Bob Burnett designed, which is kind of fun. But computer engineering, I realized kind of the end of my computer engineering that I belong more in business than computer engineering. So love the skills, but I was more of a people person.
Yeah.
So shortly after college, actually, I discovered solar, and I discovered solar because of peak oil. So it was this sort of a counterculture fear that was in the population about us running out of oil at some point. I was like, hey, I want to participate in that transformation. And I saw solar as a viable means to help with that. And so I got really excited about solar, jumped in, got into sales, and then eventually led to a leadership role in that industry.
How have your thoughts on energy with solar and natural gas and oil and wind and nuclear and all of these different things, like how has your thought process evolved on that? I mean, from when you were younger?
Yeah, it's evolved a lot for sure. I'm very pragmatic about it at this point. I think the key for me is application specific, right? So just to use a very simple example, like, hey, if I'm going to go build a hotel, I want a diesel powered tractor to do that, right? Very energy dense source is needed for that versus I don't want a battery driven tractor, right? Like that just doesn't make sense. The application isn't right. And so in the same way, like, hey, with rooftop solar, you're reusing real estate that exists there. Like, why wouldn't you power your home? But does it make sense to go, you know, take over the desert and put solar panels all over that to generate power? I mean, it takes 5 acres to produce 1 megawatt of energy with solar, right? So it's like, it's variable. I think it's very application.
That's a great answer. Is that still the case with solar? Does it still take 5 acres to produce 1 megawatt, or are the solar panels getting better and better?
They are definitely. Like when I got into the industry, like a single solar panel 3x5 was about 130 watts, something like that. And now that same solar panel is like 270 watts. Mm-hmm. So actually, and there's actually something equivalent to Moore's law. I've forgotten it. Where basically, like every 18 months, the efficiency improves by 20% or something of that nature. But basically, 5 acres per megawatt—that's a recent metric, right? So it used to be more than that.
Oh wow.
Yeah, but you know, at the same time, you see China is plugging in so many solar panels right now. I mean, it's astronomical. So they clearly have something worked out. I think it's, you know, unfortunately, renewables have all gotten thrown in the same bucket, and there's nuance to either.
Yeah.
And I'm still very pro solar in the right application, but like wind kind of is more of a question mark for me because of the variability.
It's
there.
So intermittent.
And, yeah, it's so intermittent.
I mean, it makes sense in some capacities. Like you said, it's use case specific.
Like for instance, like you go to Palm Desert in Southern California, right? There's a natural wind tunnel that blows 24/7, 365 days a year. Great. Yeah. But like anywhere that you don't have that doesn't really make sense. And then there's things that have come up that I didn't realize so much that I now really care about, which is like, you know, I've got friends off the central coast of California and they were looking to do some big wind farms out there, but they've discovered like they really disrupt the whales in a very substantial way, like, you know, killing them sort of thing almost.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's basically reverberations.
I think Trump said something about that at one point, or like, they're killing the whales. And everyone was like, oh, look at that guy. You know, he's an idiot. But then he's right, you know?
Yeah, it sounds crazy when you hear about it. But then you think about, like, you got this big steel thing, like, sitting in the ocean and, like, the wind turbine turning. It's just sitting there vibrating and creating this frequency that messes them up.
I actually just, speaking of that, I have a new baby and she's, like, 4 months old.
Congrats.
And, like, She loves when I sit with her and we watch like Planet Earth. So we're watching. So she's just so fascinated by David Attenborough's voice or whatever. And like they were doing, there was the part about the whales. They were talking about like how they communicate, right? And like how they communicate in certain zones and the voice. So that's actually, it's kind of wild. But I am curious to know how it actually, like how the wind farm, how the wind turbine would actually like kill them. But I can if it's making all that noise, I mean, I guess it would, you know, they can't talk and communicate.
I'm not an expert in this. Let me just preface this. But my understanding is not kill them directly, but more like mess up their migratory patterns and then their breeding cycles. So it leads to like a decline in the population, you know, and that sort of thing.
I mean, California has, there's a lot of like whales and stuff that go along there. I was in San Diego and I went to somewhere and we saw like a bunch of whales or something. It was wild. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Growing up on the Oregon coast, that was actually a big thing. Tourists would come into the area just to, you know, spot humpback whales. You could see them out at the sea. It was pretty cool.
So let's change gears a little bit here. Tell me what wild sats are.
Yeah.
Right, you use this in your quote here. We got you up here. Stay humble, stack wild sats, and we'll keep winning, champs. Yeah. Ken Halliburton.
Yeah, it was a term that we coined to just mean sats are, wild sats are those that you get directly from the protocol, right? And there's a big distinction between those, in my opinion, than the ones that you buy, in that you are the first owner of them, right? You're a producer instead of a consumer. A consumptive mode is to go to an exchange and buy and then pull those off, right? And you have all the trappings that come with, you know, the surveillance system that surrounds the banking apparatus, versus when you mine them, you're mining them directly from the protocol. And guess what? Satoshi designed the network to distribute tokens, Bitcoin, through mining. He didn't design the Bitcoin network so that people could go buy to get their Bitcoin, right? So to me, there's actually like a core philosophical piece that has been missing in the Bitcoin ecosystem for some time now. And, I can get into the history at some point if you want to get there, but around 2013, the timeline split and people started to buy instead of mine. But before that, everybody was getting their Bitcoin through mining.
One of my favorite things about Bitcoin is that every answer seems to open another door. You start by buying Bitcoin, then you learn about self-custody, then mining, then energy, then economics. It never really ends. That's one of the reasons I love SaaS mining. It gives people a chance to experience an entirely different side of Bitcoin that most people never see. If you've been looking for the next step down the rabbit hole, I've linked them below.
Become more than a Bitcoin buyer. Become a producer. SaaSmining.com.
Now, back to the show.
Back to the early days, right? Satoshi designed Bitcoin, launched the first the network in early 2009. And Bitcoin produced was only available through mining. And if you ran a Bitcoin node at that point, 2009 to 2013, it was just a simple little toggle. And most OGs, if you meet from that era, they were mining their own Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And when you talk to them, they have like this affection for mining as a risk, right? But what happened in 2013 really split the timeline. And that was the ASIC was one thing, but two things happened, and the ASIC made it more challenging, right? Created more friction.
So it's funny that you mentioned that, because like I started mining like 2014, 2015, and that was like the first ASICs had kind of like come out.
Yeah.
And like I was just a college kid, and I was like, I was trying to get some Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I actually started mining Ethereum like right around when it launched, just because like I could use like gaming. I went to the, you know, Best Buy and get GPUs to like mine with.
Yeah.
But like with Bitcoin, like I was like, oh, I don't have a 220 volt outlet, and I don't have like... you go on eBay, it's like $6,000 for, I think it was like an S7 or an S9 at the time. It was like something ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I could just go to Best Buy and get like, you know, four GPUs for like a couple hundred bucks each and plug it into my computer and, you know, do a little bit of some, you know, engineering from some YouTube videos, and boom, I'm off to the races. So I have a special affection for GPUs just because they're so accessible, right? And when Satoshi first set up Bitcoin, it was, you know, CPU mining, and GPUs, you know, came a little bit after that. But now today it is harder for the average person to mine with an ASIC. I mean, you can't deny that.
Yeah. And that friction. So the same friction caused you to go towards Ethereum, right?
Yeah.
Had you been able to get ASICs as cheap, or the hardware been there, you probably would have gone towards Bitcoin, right? And so that was one thing.
I had to mine ETH and swap a little bit to get my Bitcoin. So that's what I had to do.
Yeah. You got there eventually. Went the roundabout way. The other thing that happened, though, in 2013 was Coinbase opened their doors, and they were really the first exchange that made it easy to buy, right? And as a result, you made it easier to buy and harder to acquire through mining, and so the timeline split. And as a result, there's been downstream consequences, right? And I think largely the biggest is that there's amnesia, right? The buyers actually have forgotten what it's like to mine, and that's led to centralization on the mining network. So the way I point this out to most people is, up until recently, like in the last year, this has started to change. But if you went to a mining conference, you know, 2 years ago, you would never find any, you would find very, very few Bitcoiners there, right? And if you go to a Bitcoin conference, you very rarely find miners there, right? They were just completely divorced communities. And I think that has allowed people, so I use the PubCos, publicly traded mining companies, as like my primary example, but those guys have a fiduciary responsibility to return dollars to their investors, not Bitcoin. And so as a result, you have all this hash rate that's been on the network that's there using Bitcoin as a stepping stone to dollars, and that doesn't necessarily lead to the most alignment with the network. They're not necessarily going to care that the mining pools are starting to get centralized, that all the hardware comes from just one entity in China, right? So I think that the fact that the Bitcoin community went off to buy their Bitcoin instead of mine it has caused some problems.
Mm. I think you used the term fiat hashers. Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah.
When you use that term?
Yeah, fiat hashers. So I think of those folks as the folks that are just, Bitcoin's here as a stepping stone. Those dollars is what I'm after.
You know, you're kind of seeing that now, actually. Honestly, if you look at a lot of the pubcos turning off and going towards AI, so like that's happening at a major scale. I mean, they do have a fiduciary duty to maximize profits. And I think that's honestly, I think it's a healthy thing for the network in the long term to have some of those bigger, you know, huge corporation pubcos, you know, kind of transition to where, you know, it's more profitable, right? Like they can do AI and compute, which is going to help humanity in a different way, right? But it kind of allows the people who are OGs and who really care about the mission of Bitcoin to, and that are in the mining community, myself, to have a little bit more of the pie, right? Which is cool. And you know, especially that goes downstream to the little guys too, who have one or two miners, right? Or like the couple miners we have out in our little server room there that we, you know, we use to train our team and teach them about mining.
Yeah, it's 100% right from my perspective as well. I think that people have a preference for why they come to mining. So I describe it like this, right? You know, in physics, there's this idea that light can be either a particle or a wave, and it depends on how you look at it.
Is that like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? I can't remember what it's called.
No, I think that's something slightly different.
Paul, can you look that up for us?
A particle-wave duality, I think, is what...
Particle-wave duality?
That might be it. It might be something along those lines. Point being that there's something very similar with mining, and when people show up at mining, they have a preference that they don't reveal till later, and that preference is what's their money? What are they after, right? And if you're after Bitcoin, you actually have a pretty good experience. If you're after dollars, mm-hmm. a lot of folks have a bad experience, right? And mm-hmm. you can see it by how people behave after they get in, what they're really there for.
Wave-particle duality.
Wave-particle.
This is the theory from the quantum mechanics that answers your question. Light behaves as both a particle and a wave, depending on the experiment you perform. Lex Friedman had like a physics guy on who's like on the front. It was like a 4-hour podcast and I was driving and I was just listening to this guy talk and it was just like so interesting just hearing like, you know, all of the stuff going on the frontiers of physics.
Oh, it's
I'm like, I didn't think I could listen to this for 4 hours, but I was just kind of fascinated about string theory and whether string theory is actually going to be, if they're even able to test it and how he's talking about these, the giant loops. Where they smash
the accelerators.
The accelerators. And he's talking about how he worked on the team for the accelerator here in the US. And then they were building the other one in Switzerland or whatever. That was like 10, 20 times better or whatever. And he thinks that like, you know, they're smashing these particles together and running so many simulations. And it's just so fascinating how they like have all these collisions. And then like they think they're using like AI or something now where they can pull out like, if there's a million collisions, they can't look at them all. So they have to use some tool to like find the 1% of the collisions to look at. And then from there, they got to go down and it kind of like helps prove, you know, these different theories that they have. It's incredible. Humanity has, you know, you think humanity is just like, we're going down the tubes, but like the longer time goes, the more specialization we get, the more technology progresses and the more ingenuity humans have. It's just incredible to me to hear what people are working on in their little rabbit holes, right?
That one is accelerating too, right? Like AI is really liberating these massive data sets and being able to find the patterns that we couldn't see.
What I love right now that's happening is like people like just using like Claude or using open source models or using whatever. You can't use Claude anymore because apparently it's illegal to ask about bio things, right? People are curing cancer and stuff now for like their family members or for their dog and like just the frontiers of research, right? Like just, you know, using prompts and digging through these data sets and having AI help and assist to do these things. So this could be a tool for like, you know, liberty and freedom, or it could be a massive tool of oppression, right? And we're at this phase, the same thing with AI and the same thing with money, right? And Bitcoin kind of offers this other alternative where people can be more free.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how these are both like on a similar trajectory, right? Like not exactly the same mm-hmm. trajectory, but when you look at AI and the fact that you can liberate intelligence, mm-hmm. right, at massive scale. Like I think the last time we had something similar was the printing press, which liberated knowledge, right? Yeah. Now we have liberated intelligence. Mm-hmm. Like, look what all happened since we liberated knowledge with the printing mm-hmm. press. What's going to happen with liberated intelligence? I have no idea. But I do agree, like Jevons' paradox is going to play out here and we're going to see all sorts of use cases.
It's a fascinating time to be alive.
Think of like what my grandparents experienced and then I like project in the future and think about what my grandkids will experience. Yeah. And then I look at that gap in between
and things are accelerating even faster. Yeah, things are accelerating like even faster now.
Yeah.
Hopefully things get even better as time progresses. We'll have less war, less destruction, more cooperation. you know. I'm just excited. I like the way Elon thinks. Like, let's go into the cosmos. Like, let's become multiplanetary. Let's see what else is out there, right?
I think anybody that thinks that they know exactly where this is going is, I don't buy. I don't believe anybody that thinks they know where it's going. I mean, it's just a collision, Cambrian explosion of like all this technology and ideas at the same time. And I mean, I'm here for it. And at the same time, I'm very clear that we're pretty close to some sort of crisis in the fourth turning, right? So like, there's something like kind of cataclysmic and exciting. And it's like, okay, 5 to 10 years, like we'll settle down and be able to see it in the rearview mirror is kind of
maybe it'll, maybe it'll be a quick crisis and, you know, we'll get through it, right?
From your lips to God's ears, sir. I hope that is the case.
Well, usually these crises occur when, like, I think there's like a level of inequality or a level of like people feel like they can't make it, and there's such a struggle there. Like maybe with this ultimate abundance, like that's created, that like we can kind of skip that. I mean, I'm being optimistic here. Like maybe we can, you know, keep everybody comfortable even through a transition, because we just have so much abundance through capitalism, through the free markets and through everything that's being developed and happening now. But, you know, obviously I may be overly optimistic and hopeful.
Well, it's I think if you're not delusionally optimistic, like what are you doing? It's way better life than being practically pessimistic.
I know, right? Like way better life. Like.
Yeah, it's. But I think you're onto something there. Like the intelligence. I think for me, it comes down to like how quickly we adopt Bitcoin is like kind of a backbone. Like, what if it becomes currency, or if it just becomes the global store of value? I'm not quite sure on that point yet. But what I do know is that the sooner that we can move to a deflationary currency that matches like the speed of this technology boom to capture that, the better humanity is going to do.
You're a big Jeff Booth guy, right? I know
I am.
You read his book and that. Yeah. Is that what kind of turned you on to Bitcoin in the first place? Or?
No. So no. I went on a big walkabout in between my rooftop solar career. So I was an executive there, you know, saved my pennies in the bank, and then a new executive came in, and I could see he was going to kind of take the company off a cliff. Mm-hmm. And I'd always had a dream of world travel, so I threw on a backpack and went on a walkabout for a couple years. And so it happened to be that I was...
Our producer did that too at one point. He disappeared on me. Yeah, we've been friends for a long time, so he decided to just throw on a backpack. He changed his name to Forrest, and he disappeared off into the forest.
All right. Well played, sir.
Calls me up. He's like, yeah, I'm at this farm, and like all the girls are naked, and we're just hanging out. I'm like, all right, Forrest, well, have fun, buddy. Don't make me jealous.
Yeah.
This is probably like 15 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is like 2014 to 16 for me. So a while ago, right? And I met my now wife, but also discovered Bitcoin around the same time. And this was in the Sacred Valley of Peru, where I had extra time, and I was just checking out things online, and I came across the dollar vigilante and crypto anarchism and Bitcoin, and what is this thing? And the combination of computer engineering, where I had like a focus on networking, the energy background.
It just all clicked for you, man. And you had all the perfect background for
this. It struggles to get money out of ATMs across the planet. Yeah. I was just like, oh, it's there. Like, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. Right. And then, but it wasn't until I read Jeff Booth's The Price of Tomorrow that I realized mining is where I belong.
Yeah. I'm hoping to get Jeff in here at some point to like do a book. One of my favorite things to do is like deep dive book series with authors.
Oh, cool.
I've got a couple of them done. I think we did The Big Print with Larry Lepard. I did, what else did I do? I did Daylight Robbery with Dominic Frisby, which is a history of taxation. That was cool. I did Knut Svanholm. We did his book. Mm-hmm. So like, I've done a lot of those, and it's like, I'm missing Aaron Van Weerden. We did the Genesis book, which talks about like all of the, everything that led up to the creation of Bitcoin. So those are like my favorite things to do. So if you know Jeff, tell him to get on Maddie's pod and let's do that deep dive on his book.
Cool, man.
But yeah, man, that's super cool. I had another question for you about all this, but it went right out of my mind because I got so excited.
All good.
You're talking about. Let's talk a little bit about power and about cheap power and energy and how Bitcoin mining is largely, it makes sense to be more green because we're so variable with the energy. And then it kind of like is this feedback loop that leads back, like we can finance all these green projects because like we can turn off at any point. And because we, you know, if we can get a cheap deal, like we can be there, right? What are your thoughts there?
I think the simple way I think about that is Bitcoin is the buyer of first resort and last resort, right? And what I mean by that is first resort is cool. There's no way to monetize that power. Bitcoin can come in and be that buyer that can justify an entire project, right? So you've got off-grid flared natural gas, right? You can set up and monetize that. So the way I think about this is that Bitcoin is the buyer of first resort and last resort. So first resort being that you can come in and monetize a power asset that doesn't have any other buyer. So think flared natural gas that's off in the boonies, right? Like you can set up a gen set next to it, put a little pod of mining rigs there. And now you can suddenly export via Bitcoin that energy through Bitcoin into a globally liquid commodity. And then last resort, meaning that like this wind farm that we're mining off of in West Texas, this wind farm is producing the power, but there's a lot of that's primarily power in the data center there. But that wind power was being sold to the grid, and that grid there had a lot of congestion, right? So there's points in time where they were getting negative electricity. And so it was hard to justify continuing to operate the wind farm, but bring in Bitcoin miners. And now suddenly, hey, negative's pretty good to us. We'll buy it for, you know, a couple cents and then turn around and monetize that for you. So you always have somebody to sell your power to, your last resort.
Tell me about the story of the guy who thought that something about his this light switch in his house was using the same amount of energy as like Bitcoin mining or something like that.
Oh, so this is a heuristic that I've developed from my days in rooftop solar. So the story goes that I was out in Antioch, California, and had gotten a couple of leads, and I was out there with one of my sales reps, and there was two customers. Their houses were like either right across the street or right next door to each other. So think a home development, right? Where all the homes are basically the same, right? Slight variation of the floor plan in each home, but basically the same, right? So go into one house, it's, you know, the guy was an energy miser, right? And had like $40 a month of electricity use. I mean, very low. His house was hot. Like, it wasn't a very comfortable place, but the numbers didn't make sense for solar as a result. Like, the weird part in California about solar is the way energy works is the more you use, the more expensive it gets. It's meant to penalize you and try to keep your energy usage low. Then I went across the street to this other house, and this guy, he was using tons of electricity. House was cold, big old pool in the back. He had a sun tanning bed upstairs. And I walk in there, and he's got like a $400 or $500 a month electric bill. And he's telling me, he's like, hey, I know the guy across the street. We have the same house. I can't figure out how I'm using so much power. I mean, I only flip these four switches every day. Like, and I realized right then and there, because energy isn't something people can see. Yeah. They can't conceptualize it. They conceptualize it by like physical devices that they're turning on and off, regardless of what those switches are powering, right? So for him, it was like, what's going on? This seems absurd. Why do I have such a huge bill? And so I just realized, like, okay, the common person, like, in my opinion, can't understand energy very effectively. Mm-hmm. It's all meaningless. It's all like in thought space, and people need to make things tangible, right? Like, oh, cool. I see how many light bulbs are on in this room. That's how much energy I'm using. Forget like I'm—
Another thing they don't teach in school.
Yes. Yeah.
Credit,
absolutely.
Taxes, how energy works, all the stuff you do on a daily basis.
Or the most basic one for me that I've realized over time as well is that people don't understand that you can't store electricity, right? Like the entire grid is like a closed loop. You put power on it, it's gotta be consumed, right? If it can't, it has to go to ground. Like
that was like a crazy thing for me to understand, was like balancing the grid. I think I had Mark Atemko here from Ocean, and he actually worked from Ocean Mining. I think he's the president of Ocean Mining.
Yeah.
And he actually worked in like a grid control room. And this is what a lot of people don't get, is like, you got to like balance this stuff out. Like, if these guys, if the grid's like has this level of demand and it's like super hot out, and like, you know, you got to like turn on emergency power to like keep this thing stable. So there's entire rooms of like operators, almost like you'd think like they're going to space or something, and they're working in the NASA room, and they're doing all these different things. It's like, it's the same thing for like electricity grids, which is like kind of wild.
Yeah, it is. But so coming back to like what we were just talking about, though, most people tend to think like any other product, hey, if I don't use it, I've got extra saved, right? Mm-hmm. That's not how the grid works.
Yeah.
It's just that guy like Mark Atemko that's sitting in a control room and saying, oh, cool, this whole section of the grid, everybody turned off their lights. Now I need to turn off this generator here. And that has a cost to turn off that generator, right? So it doesn't make total intuitive sense for people like how the grid works. And, you know, as a result, I think there's been a lot of like politics deciding how the grid should work instead of like physics people, energy people. You know, it's like, hey, we got physical reality we got to deal with here. I know that you guys like this, but this is actually how things work.
Well, the government loves to get involved. They have all these utilities and all this stuff. So it's, you know, less of a free market around most of the United States as it probably should be. And it's probably higher energy prices are probably a direct downstream consequences of that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think ERCOT is proving that, right? Yeah. Like they have some of the cheapest energy and the freest grid.
There you go.
And at the same time, they're having to innovate as they go. I think it's the freest, largest grid on the planet right now. And they're, through the price signals and everything, figuring out how to deal with the challenge of the hyperscalers that need all this, you know, gigawatts of electricity, while at the same time, like where you put it, how the electricity goes down, which lines. I mean, it's really complicated to run a grid. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad I don't do it. I'm not a rocket scientist.
Well, it would be a lot easier once we get battery technology much better, right? There's got to be, the future has to include some kind of way to store. I mean, I always think about like ways where they can like take water. And I think somebody had a design where you bring water up and then you bring it down and that creates physics. Like you can, so that kind of was an interesting way to store energy that I thought about, but you know, just like solar technology, battery technology is also getting better. So 10, 20, 30 years from now, maybe we use Claude and say, how do I make better batteries and study physics and tell me how to do it? And it'll pop out some ideas.
I mean, it's coming. You're absolutely right. Like, I think that the grid is going to transform with the combination of reducing battery prices. Like batteries are effective now. The problem is the cost, right? It just doesn't, it's hard to justify in a lot of places. But as that goes down, now you suddenly can insert storage onto the grid. And I think storage plus Bitcoin mining plus solar
panels. Bitcoin mining, I mean, we are that kind of like that battery that can take excess load.
Yeah.
Now, you know, can we be the battery? We can also kind of be the battery that gives back energy when it's needed, right? So we are effectively right now kind of a battery for the grid. The whole Bitcoin network is a battery for the grid in a way.
In a virtual way. Yeah, in a virtual way. We can't store energy. We're consumers of electricity.
True.
So that's a different dynamic.
But we can't store it, but we can give it back.
You can give it back. Right? Exactly.
The biggest thing of all the curtailment programs that I participate in, which is like, hey, turn off a couple megawatts and we can just give that kind of back to the grid when it's needed, right?
Exactly. And it's a highly valuable resource to have that, and it's slightly different dynamic than when batteries are there that consume and then don't consume but store it for future use. So anyway, I think the combination of all of that though and AI is going to lead to a very intelligent grid that will figure out where to put the power and
exactly
when.
Let me ask you one final question about energy before we move on, and this is just a hypothetical. If energy were free tomorrow, what would happen to Bitcoin?
You know, this is one I've thought about quite a bit. And I think if energy were free, I think we've got societal issues. I mean, that's abundance, right? Because you can see that human civilization and energy use coincide, right? Like the most civilized places on the planet use the most amount of energy. So where does that put us? I don't know. But that gets into kind of sci-fi space to have free energy. And I don't know in that space that we would actually need money. I don't know what that reality looks like. I've thought about this and I just don't know.
Interesting.
What's your take?
Well, I mean, like, I think in a lot of places, water is mostly free now. I mean, if it's not, obviously there's places that need water, but if you live here in the United States, I mean, you can essentially go to anywhere and kind of get free water. I think we'll have a lot more people being able to do things, progress. I think eventually energy does become mostly free. I think, you know, whether that's 100 years from now, 20 years from now, who knows? But I think that just the state of progress that we're seeing in science and technology and physics, and, you know, they'll probably have, like, you know, in the future, a little thing that can produce a megawatt of energy, right? They'll be able to figure out how to do it safely. I'm just speculating here, but I don't think anything happens to Bitcoin if that happens. I think there's still proof of work that goes into mining and operating machines and, you know, hiring people to deal with that and training people to do it and replacing fans and replacing hashboards and, you know, actively doing that. So I don't think it would necessarily change the dynamic on the Bitcoin network. It might, you know, it will become more competitive because if energy is free, that's one big factor in it. But maybe it would also democratize it more. Anybody can just have, you know, a Bitcoin miner at their house, right? Which is kind of cool. It makes the network more decentralized. So I don't think society would break down. I think we'd be okay.
I'm not saying we die or the species goes extinct or anything, but I think it's a very different reality than what we currently are living in.
Let's move on a little bit here. I think you've been quoted as saying, the right to transact comes before every other right. Make the case for me there with Bitcoin.
Yeah. So this, I have to give credit to Troy Cross, who's an advisor, and some work, and maybe it's linked to some things that RFK Jr. has said. But if you think about it, you know, the founders of the Constitution, currency was never anything but physical, right? Mm-hmm. And so the founders of the Constitution never could conceive of how we transact now.
Yeah.
And how we transact now enables like government to basically be like a man in the middle.
Yeah.
And to decide if you can or cannot through regulations. And that creates an interesting power dynamic, because if you think about it, if you want to express any of your rights, most of them, right? Maybe not the Fourth Amendment, which you've got up on the on the wall. I don't know how this necessarily applies, but the First Amendment, let's say you want to go express yourself by going to a protest. You want to go to Occupy, you need a bus ticket to get there. That's going to require purchasing something. You need pen and paper to hold up a sign or to make a sign that you're going to hold up at the protest. Mm-hmm. That all has costs. So you need to be able to buy things. So to be able to even express yourself, have freedom of expression, or let's say digitally online.
Yeah,
right?
No, I mean, you're 100% correct. Yeah, I mean, it's like I had Benjamin, BJ Dichter, I don't know if you know him, he helped lead the Canadian trucker convoy protest.
Oh, cool.
He wrote a book about it called Honking for Freedom. So we're actually doing his book series on and off.
Nice.
You know, anytime that he can come to town to hang out. But yeah, I mean, it's like money. The question is money part of speech, right? It is speech, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like money is speech, I guess. If you have that, then maybe it does fall under the First Amendment. We can maybe push back on a lot of this stuff.
Well, that was kind of an argument that Troy Cross was making at one point, is not necessarily exactly like fall under freedom of speech, but it is a form of expression, right? Like what we spend our money on is kind of an expression of what we value. Mm-hmm. And like, hey, if you can't go out and buy a gun, can you really have the right to bear arms?
Yeah.
Right. And so the ability to transact, I think, should be enshrined in the Bill of Rights.
I agree with you, man. I think we should push this forward.
Let's do it. Let's make a movement.
This brings me to my next favorite topic to talk about with Bitcoiners. It's like, I'm so happy we have this thing called KYC. It works so well.
It's not a honeypot or anything, is it?
I think being a Bitcoiner, one of the things that I see constantly that frustrates me more than anything in this world. And I think our last episode was... I think one of the last episodes I did was with one of our Bitcoin meetup community members, and she recently got scammed. You know, she lost like a lot of her life savings, and it was because her data was in a honeypot, right? And like she just, you know, they knew all this stuff about her. And I think what the government and what people don't realize is that just because you have a policy doesn't mean that it actually works, right? So you can have like hell was paved on the, you know, on the road of good intentions, right? And you know, KYC is just one of those policies, know your customer, that for, you know, as far as I can see, when it comes to money and different things, it just does not work. You know, like I think 99% of all of the fraud and crime still occurs, even with KYC, people still get around it and do it. So you're not really stopping the criminals. And then, well, who does it actually harm, right? It harms all of these elderly people or people that, you know, give all their information and then it goes to some unsecure database. And then, you know, hackers come in and take all that information and sell it on the dark web. And then all those people get scammed left and right.
Well, you know, I'm hoping AI breaks down the KYC paradigm. I'll give you the reason why. But first, I want to share, like, how different is that than security at the airports, right? Mm-hmm. Like, have you seen, like, these penetration tests that people do to see, like, how successful they are at stopping, like, fake bombs from coming across the security? It's like 96% fail rate or something.
Are you serious?
I mean, it's horrible.
I have not seen
it. It's horrible. It's similar. It's a very similar thing as like KYC. But if you look at it, now these honeypots, right? They're taking our biometric information and they're storing it in these honeypots. Mm-hmm. What happens when a fable or mythos tracks those honeypots, then goes and pretends they're Maddie out there, calls your mom and convinces your mom that you've got a life-threatening situation to extort your mom? Like, that is coming. Like, it's horrible. It's horrible that we've allowed this to happen. But to be fair, like, the politicians are very good at convincing through fear that we need things for our protection and to protect our kids. Like, that's used over and over again to insert, like, draconian measures that just really seem like command and control sort of features of a government.
Yeah, man. I couldn't agree with you more. Could not agree with you more. So, public miners pivoting to AI, I think it's a good thing. It seems like you might not think it's a good thing.
No, I think it's wonderful.
Oh, you think it's wonderful? Okay, you do agree with me. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, here's...
Because I think you said it's like a trap or something like that.
No, I don't know if I said it was a trap. I think here's the thing. To me, back to what I was talking about with mining, it kind of reveals people's preference.
Okay.
Right? So these publicly traded miners, they are now outing themselves as after dollars, not Bitcoin. Hmm. So I was at the Texas Energy Mining Summit about 2 months ago now, and somebody on stage, I think it was Rafa Zaguri, from Electron, he said this on stage and it just really clicked with me. Somebody was asking him, hey, you've got these sites, like, for your investors, doesn't it make sense that you're pivoting them and starting to go towards AI? And he's like, look, if an AI company can come in here and use my site, it means I can profit from it. I'm going to sell that site. I'm going to take the profits, put into Bitcoin, and now I'm going to go find another site.
Yeah.
To me, that's the right answer as a Bitcoiner.
I like that idea.
And so to me, what we're seeing actually is the revealed preference of these entities. Mm-hmm. They're showing themselves as dollars are more important to them than Bitcoin. That's their money. Great. That means people that are after dollars are pivoting off the network while the network is being secured by more people after Bitcoin. And that's better social layer for the network.
Makes good sense. So I mentioned earlier about a scam from one of our community members. I think you went public with a scam that cost you some money. You flew to Amsterdam for a deal. You know, you went kind of public about this. Walk me through that. Like, what exactly happened?
Oof, yeah, it's in the rear view mirror at this point. But yeah, I went public with it because it was definitely something I felt a lot of shame, guilt about. But I wanted other people to know because I wasn't aware that that type of attack could exist, right? So somebody posed as a client, set themselves up for a big deal. I happened to be going to the Baltic Honey Badger last August. And so the timing was right. I stopped through Amsterdam, met with them, three-piece suits, fancy four-star lunch in a hotel. They wanted to do a deal. They had some constraints on it that I said, yeah, I can't do it the way you guys want to. So I walked away from it. And then I went down to check out a data center opportunity. And they came back and said, okay, we can come to your terms. Like, the only thing is we need to meet up again. So went to meet up again, same thing, four-star restaurant. I'm exhausted at this point in the trip. And I'm like, okay, let's bring a contract. You sign it. So the deal was that they were going to have a contract signed and ready for me to pick up at the airport when I left the next day. And in the meantime, they were going to purchase a small amount of Bitcoin as part of the contract from us. We mine Bitcoin. We can sell Bitcoin. Not a problem as a one-off transaction. So size it to be a small percentage of the overall deal. And at the time that we met, they asked me to download Atomic Wallet, which is a wallet on the App Store. I looked briefly on my Apple phone. It's got four stars. It looks like a legitimate wallet. We put a little bit of Bitcoin in it. So he sends me a little bit of Bitcoin. So he's got the address. He knows it works. You know, he played it as, hey, this is just an app that we feel comfortable with because we've used in the past. I don't think anything of it because I trust Apple.
Yeah.
And then I go back to the hotel and test it out. Make sure the seed phrase works. Make sure I can send, receive. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. It seems like a good wallet that's working. Send the rest of the Bitcoin into the wallet for doing the transaction because he wanted to see proof of Bitcoin in order to complete the full transaction. And while odd, it was just like, okay, this is a very rich family office. Maybe they've got some weird trust things where he doesn't know me that well, except for a couple of meals together. But, you know, as soon as the Bitcoin was deposited in the wallet got swept. To this day, I have no idea how he did it. There's two competing theories.
Wow.
Either the app is compromised or somehow they got the seed phrase when I was setting up the wallet in the hotel. But, you know, the guy was like from me to you on a couch and he didn't look like he was looking over my shoulder when I set up the app. So I don't know how it happened. I just wanted to go public because to me, I'd never heard of a... And so magazine...
Was it on like a public Wi-Fi network or something?
It wasn't. I was using a 4G. So the thing to me why I went public with it is because I did not know that it was possible for somebody to... I've heard of a lot of social engineering attacks. Uh-huh. So very cautious of those, of course. Uh-huh. But having somebody pose as a client... meet in four-star like luxury place. I mean, they invested thousands of dollars in the scam.
Yeah.
Right?
And did he ever like after that, did he just cut off contact completely?
Like, oh yeah. Yeah. We went to the police, Secret Service. Like I went the full nine yards.
And
like,
but this was in Amsterdam, right?
Yeah. So it turns out Wired Magazine ran an article on it. They did got a journalist involved.
Wow.
They went deep on it. They I think Chainalysis got involved and talked with them about it. Their conclusion was it was a band of gypsies. That they're known criminals in the space that are running this sort of a scam. Way.
So was the wallet legitimate or?
I don't know.
Or was it just like, did they just?
I will say this. Was it
actually Atomic Wallet or?
I heard of a lot of other folks that had similar sort of stories that came using this wallet. And at the same time, Chainalysis says that somebody got my seed phrase. That was their conclusion. I don't know what to make because I can't say definitively. But I tell everybody not to use Atomic Wallet if they have a choice.
Wow. That's crazy. What an interesting story.
Yeah. I just didn't know that sort of attack existed or I would have been on the lookout for it, right? Like, that's why I went public is just to let people know, like, hey, there are people that are going to meet with you in person and do face-to-face scamming of your Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like, that exists.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was something like from a James Bond movie, like genuinely, like two meetings, like I, you know, literally bought a suit to go meet with these guys, like luxury office out of like Luxembourg. And
we're talking like five figures, six figures, seven figures here. Like
was it six figure?
So okay, so that was a decent payoff for them for 1 to 2.
Oh no, no, from us, what they scammed was not six figure. They definitely like I think were upset that they didn't get more from what they put up. It was a six figure deal that we were contemplating. Wow. Yeah. Gotcha.
Wow, that's just crazy.
Yeah, it's single-handedly the most exotic scam that I've heard of in the space, and it happened to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank my lucky stars.
Well, I've got, you know, we've all have stories of how we're stupid, right? You know, like I didn't fully appreciate the whole self-custody thing, and I had some kid helping me when I first came in, and like I got millions of dollars of coin on a broken hard drive or something, so you know how that goes.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, the way everything's gone, but who knows if that's even true, if it wasn't just a scam all along, you just ran off with it. I mean, you just don't know, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Keys, not your coins. There's a lot of lessons that you learn, right? And you pay for your education. It's just, it's part of the process, right? You know, it's part of the process.
Yeah, I had another founder tell me, he's like, hey, congratulations. You guys are making it.
You guys are making it.
You guys are making it if you're having somebody attack you in that way.
Yep.
And
yep,
I was like, ah, God, that's not inspiring to hear that there's that much devious, that many devious folks out there.
So we're still early on in the timeline of Bitcoin and everything that's going on in the world. I think you've compared Bitcoin to the Milan Cathedral, which took 570 years to build.
Yes.
Why is that the right way to think about what we're doing here?
Well, actually, go a step further. Like, mm-hmm. for Bitcoin to truly be successful, it's got to be the monetary base that gold has been, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, we've had an interlude here with fiat. So we went gold, fiat. So America is what I'm speaking about when I say this. So the American culture, gold, fiat. But gold has been used as, like, the base for money for thousands of years, right?
Yeah.
So fiat's an interlude, and Bitcoin for the digital reality we're moving into is a great gold replacement because it removes the limitation of physicality.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so now we can transact at the same speed at which the digital economy allows us to transact. Yeah. So we can settle at the same speed that we can transact. So to me, it's obvious that Bitcoin has to replace gold. So if we're going to replace gold, then by definition, Bitcoin needs to be a 1,000-year-plus project, right? And so what are other 1,000-year projects we've set out on? And one, it's not 1,000 years, is the Milan Cathedral.
I've used that. That's like
a 600-year project. Yeah, like, can you imagine?
5 to 10 generations of human life.
Yeah, if you say 4 generations per 100 years, then that's 4 times 5. It's, you know, 20 generations, 25 generations for 550. Yeah. So we're not talking about that much time, but are we setting out to create that project right now? Have we built the community? Have we built the institution around Bitcoin in such a way that we are actually thinking of that? And I'd argue no, because if you look at our community right now, everybody looks at a project as 570 years and thinks, that's crazy. Why would we start a project that long? I'm thinking next quarter and my quarterly profits, right? Like, we are so you know, hamsters on a wheel right now. But the problem is our community is called to be that community that's thinking intergenerational. That's the only way we're going to survive. And so the question I keep asking people in the Bitcoin community is, what other human institutions have lasted 1,000+ years? Like, why aren't we looking at some of those to create a blueprint? Mm-hmm. And that blueprint should help to guide us. Like, there's not that many human institutions that have been around for 1,000+ years.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. The only one I can think of is like the Catholic Church. What else?
Like, I think there's like astrology is another. Like, that's an institution that's been around. I mean, loose institution, right? But it's survived for 1,000+ years. I think that probably Hinduism is another that's survived 1,000+ years. But yeah, you get into like religious territory,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Pretty quick. But when I look, you know, I went to TabConf last year and I looked at the community there, and I walked away with it being absolutely convinced that Bitcoin is heading towards ossification. And the reason I got convinced is because in that room was the core development community. I don't mean Bitcoin core. I just mean the people that are developing Bitcoin and moving it forward. And I just saw a glaring lack of other disciplines in that room. And there's, to me, if we're going to create a 1,000-year project and continue to develop Bitcoin, then we need a lot more disciplines in that room thinking about things, second, third order consequences. And so the great part about Bitcoin is Satoshi largely set something out that was quite perfect. I mean, it's not perfect. You know?
I agree with that assessment. I think, you know, if Bitcoin does ossify, is it okay for it to just be the base layer?
It is what it is.
Money. for all of humanity? And I think the answer would be yes.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, if you look at all these institutions that have lasted 1,000+ years, they have a certain, they all have like a coalesced around a certain set of values. And I think that's what we're seeing right now in the Bitcoin development ecosystem is different communities that have a value set that think Bitcoin should be one way, and that's they're using that to guide their decisions. So what's happening is a community of developers is fracturing. Now there's like a third implementation or fourth implementation that's coming up. So they're all going to look at Bitcoin slightly differently, and they're all not going to coalesce on like consensus changes, right? We're kind of seeing that right now.
We're just heading towards
awesome.
People want these different BIPs and different things, and like if everybody wanted it, it would happen, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. You know? But we don't have consensus amongst the community, and so as a result, unless it's an existential threat, I just truly believe that we're heading towards ossification for good, better, or worse. It's just pragmatic reality.
No, I think it's maybe it's for the good. You know, I tend to think it is in a lot of ways, right? Like existential threat, let's deal with that, right? But the more ossified you kind of have a protocol, it just seems like it's kind of more built to last, and it creates that trust and reliability, right? You trust that system and that protocol. So
yeah, I mean, it's
so what's my, that? What's that rule called where like the longer something's around, I can't remember what it's called.
Lindy.
The Lindy effect, right? Yeah. Like, so maybe there are downsides of ossification, but definitely one of the upsides is like the Lindy effect just grows, right?
Yeah, more trust is enabled. I mean, my personal bias is that the development community should not be adding features at this point, but should be looking for long range attacks and preparing for those. And
like
the
quantum situation. That
exactly. I'm not too worried about quantum. At the same time, like I want us to be a good Boy Scout and be prepared, right?
Yeah, to me,
like that's just the logical approach. Like, why are we trying to be offensive? Like, let's just focus on defense only.
I mean, at the end of the day, whether it's 3 years out or 30 years out, I mean, it's still something to start thinking about, right? Like, we don't know where it's going to fall in that scale, but at some point it will be a problem or a threat, right?
I don't know if it will be or not. I'm not totally convinced. There's some
I think Nick Carter's done a lot of work on this recently, and I think just like looking at it objectively and scientifically, the way that the qubits and stuff are going and the papers and how things are getting better, it just seems like at some point the technology is gonna get there.
No, but so I studied quantum physics in college. I almost shifted after taking quantum physics to a physics like career trajectory because I became so fascinated.
It's so interesting.
Because here's the thing with quantum physics or just quantum reality, it doesn't behave like Newtonian reality.
Yeah.
Right? Like Newtonian reality is built somehow in balls. Like, so I'm not convinced like our linear rational minds thinking about it can actually accurately project what's going to happen there. Like it just like you get into quantum and you get into like time travel stuff, right? Yeah. Like there's different timelines and also Mandela effect. And
I was listening to that Lex Fridman podcast with a guy who was like, and you just, you know, I guess they're trying to look for this grand unified theory that will just kind of like make everything fit together. But it's like when you get to the quantum world, it's like completely different than the regular Newtonian world. But like at some point there is things that tie in together that connect the two. So, you know, it's just, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're just a bunch of monkeys.
That's right.
We're just figuring shit out, you know?
Yeah. It would be good if we acknowledge more frequently that we're part of the primate family.
Right. I agree with that completely. People are way too serious about stuff. It's like, guys, we are literally monkeys. Like, get over yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
It helps to come back to that base reality. We're naked monkeys. Just get used to that.
Well, clothed monkeys now.
Hairless monkeys is what I meant to say.
Yeah. Before we wrap up here, what is the best advice someone's ever given you?
Gosh, the best advice that somebody's ever given me.
I'm getting those neurons firing in that monkey brain.
Yeah, you are. I've been given wonderful advice a lot of times in my life, and I'm trying to think. I lived with a guy right after my sophomore year of college, and he told me a couple of things about food that have always stuck with me. And I think it's really good advice in general for life. And he used to say, hey, smell your food. You got a nose for a reason. If it smells like you should eat that thing, eat that thing. You know, if it smells like you shouldn't, don't. You know, trust your body. And then the other bit that came along with that is after you eat a meal, check in with yourself 20 minutes later. Do you feel better or worse? If you feel worse, eat less of that thing. If you feel better, eat more of that thing, right? And what he did for me with those two comments is he kind of placed it at a pivotal age, like just body awareness. And I think so many people, they don't realize it, but they're living up in their heads and not in their bodies. Which is, you know, living down in Peru, I've really noticed that difference between like an American culture and a Latin American culture. Latin Americans are a lot more in their bodies than in their heads.
Yeah.
And I think that the world is much more vibrant when you're living in your body than when you're living in your head. And it's hard to know any different. But if you can do those simple things that I just said, like you might start to notice the way you perceive the world differently after time.
Kent Halliburton, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, Maddie.
The fight for privacy continues. Stay private. Stay informed. Stay cyberpunked. Down the rabbit hole. Stay informed.
Arguing that you don't care about privacy because you have nothing to hide is like saying you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say. Edward Snowden. Privacy is the power to selectively reveal oneself to the world. Satoshi Nakamoto.